So, I'm going to talk about some recent stuff that I've been doing, and based on some stuff that Juan has been doing, based on some stuff that has come before, and so on and so on. And in some sense, we have this thing called the ADS-CFT correspondence. And we would really like to have some handle on it to the level of essentially giving a proof of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So this looks overly ambitious. And I'm not going to motivate the ADS-CFT correspondence. I'm going to assume that you've heard a little bit about it already before. But I'm going to state at least one example of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And that's the statement that n equal 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory with gauge group SUN in the large n limit is equivalent to type 2B string theory on ADS 5 process 5 with flux n on S5. And the statement is that at least at the classical level, these two systems look completely different, and they're supposed to be equivalent at the level of quantum theory. So if you have this abstract equivalence between two quantum systems and you want to show that they're equivalent, you need to have some basics straightened out. The first thing is, if you're doing quantum theory, you have a Hilbert space of states. So we'll call this H1. And then you have the second Hilbert space of states, H2. And you want to make some map between these two objects and say that you have the same Hilbert space. Now, if you're a mathematician, the generic statement is all Hilbert spaces are the same. So this is not a very useful definition. What you really mean when you say quantum theory is that you have a Hilbert space of states plus a whole bunch of observables. And then you want to map the Hilbert state, the Hilbert space, with the description of the observables in the Hilbert space to the same thing over here with observables. And the typical observable is, for example, the symmetries of the system. So let's say that on this side, this is a conformal field theory. And the symmetry group of a conformal field theory in a conformal background, or a background that preserves the conformal invariance, in this case, for n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory, you get, with the supersymmetry, a group which is SU22/4. And this group of symmetries of the quantum theory has to be realized on the Hilbert space by unitary irreducible representations of this algebra. Okay? So here we want to, let's say, classify all the unitary irreducible representations of SU22/4. Similarly, over here on the type 2B supergravity theory, this SU22/4 is the set of isometries of ADS5 cross S5, including the supersymmetries. So the identification to the isometries of ADS5 cross S5, and because there are isometries of this state, tells you that the fluctuations about this state should come in representations of the isometry group by the usual quantization. So you also get unitary irreducible representations of this group. So you also get unitary irreducible representations of the isometry group over here on this side. And then what we would really want to do is show that we can match all of these. So I want to show that this is the same. So what I've told you in papers is this is the original conjecture of one. So pH 97 11 200. So basically the statement is that once you match these algebras, there should be this equivalence. So then the question is, how do you go about proving that type of equivalence, that the set of unitary irreducible representations on one side is equivalent to the other one? And moreover, we want to prove that the full quantum theory on both sides is the same. But this is hard. This we understand how to do roughly perturbatively on some level. This side, we know how to expand around the background a little bit, but we don't even know how to state the problem over here when you do large deformations from ADS5 cosS5. So the type 2B string theory over here is a theory of quantum gravity. Things can get very complicated, and we don't have a good way to go about studying these for very large deformations from ADS5 cosS5.
Minor point, it should be UN.
I'm not sure that this U1 plays that big of a role here, right? The U1 decouples. But the U1 decouples and moreover gets eaten up by the B field of the bulk sometimes. So you can carry out the UN or not. And I don't know, Juan, what do you think is. Basically, I've heard conflicting reports on which is the correct one.
The UN. Look, it has to be UN because that's the one that's
S-dual. That's the one that's S-dual. Okay. But then one has to explain what happens to a singleton. Yeah. Okay. So here we have this. And then we need to do this type 2B. String theory over here. So one of the main problems is that this is a conformal field theory. And then you get into trouble with the way we usually think about observables. So for example, if you have an ordinary field theory in four dimensions, you usually start building things from the S matrix and you do scattering amplitudes. But if you have a conformal theory, the mass squared of all particles is identically zero in a conformal vacuum. And the reason is that the vacuum is invariant under dilatations, because a conformal group in four dimensions includes the dilatations. And if you have a particle with mass m, and so if you have p squared equals to m squared, and you have an associated wave function, which is of the form e to the ipx, when you perform a dilatation on this wave function, you change p to something where you scale p by some number. And that would mean that you have to scale m by the corresponding number, but this is supposed to be an invariant of the theory. So either you have a continuous spectrum of masses, or all masses are zero, which is the fixed point of this relation under the dilatation group. One? Or there aren't any particles. But then we call the theory trivial. Well, or it's not the S matrix. So the issue is that if you were trying to do an S matrix over here, the usual type of S matrix calculation, which involves some exclusive scattering cross section, when you have some fixed number of particles in and some fixed number of particles out, gets muddied up by the fact that you can emit all these massless particles. They're there. So the usual S matrix doesn't work out too well. So you have to do something slightly different. So one of the things you can do is First of all, instead of working on the Lorentzian theory, you go Euclidean. For the first round, you go Euclidean. And then you study Green's functions of local operators. So you take your Euclidean theory, insert operators at various places, and you study the correlation functions of these states in the Euclidean theory, or these operators in the Euclidean theory. And what happens is that what makes this problem infrared safe and takes care of the infrared divergences is that you have finite distances between these points. So that finite distance acts as your infrared regulator and is what makes the theory computable. So, no, this is one way to define observables.
Right. Well, you could define these correlators and
well. Yeah, but then it gets a little bit more messy because of Lightcon singularities.
Yeah.
This is a small thing, but going Euclidean is just something that makes life easier to compute things over here. So this is a trick we usually do, and then we're happy with that. So. Well, you have to change the bosonic symmetry over here is SO42. This gets replaced by the Euclidean version, which is SO51. This gets a little bit messy because the way that spinners transform from Lorentz to Euclidean is a little bit funny. But the what you really do is you try to do the analysis over here and you use superspace techniques with eyes in appropriate places to try to do the calculation. There is a group and it's something. If you look at the complexification of the group, it's this the same complexification of this group. So, SO2/2. SO or SL? And 4 over here. Over here. And then do I have an H over here or no? Oh, okay. Wait. 1? I'm not sure the notation of okay.
Tricky point tied to the Majorana about spinners and what happens.
Yeah. So the issue is we really are working in Lorentzian and we're doing this Euclidean continuation on the Green's functions and then we leave it at that. In the end we always want to go back to the Lorentzian, which is where the physics is anyhow. So the gravity doesn't like to be on the Euclidean space either. So well, if you understand the complexified supergroup, then to make the unitary reducible representations, there are some reality constraints that you have to impose, and you will impose the ones that correspond actually to the Lorentzian symmetry in the end. I'll get to that. This is when I discuss the operator state correspondence. It's convenient to be in Euclidean and not in Lorentzian. So this is one way to go. And this gives you Green's functions of local operators, And when you get two operators close to each other, you get operator product expansions, and you characterize the conformal field theory in terms of the local operators and their operator product expansions. And this is one way to solve the problem. The second way to try to understand the theory, so this is number one. The second way to try to deal with this problem is to put the theory on a box. You put the theory on a box, then you also cure, you have an infrared regulator, and you're able to do perturbation theory with a discrete spectrum. And you're able to analyze the problem there as well. And the usual favorite box of physicists is a torus. So the usual box is a free torus, and the reason is because that preserves some of the translation symmetries. It's easy to do Fourier analysis on the torus, and it preserves some of the supersymmetries because it preserves the translation invariance. So this is one way that one usually goes, and it's dictated by a lot of reasons. But you're not required to put things on a T3. And actually, if you're doing a conformal field theory, the best box is not usually a T3, but it's rather an S3. The best box is around the S3. So let me explain why that is. And the idea is to start with the Euclidean theory over here, and to write the Euclidean metric in radial coordinates. So I factorized a factor of R squared in front of the metric. And what you realize is that up to a conformal factor, which is this R2, the metric on Euclidean R4 with the origin removed, which is the singular point of this coordinate transformation, is equivalent to the metric of around sphere, so the omega 3 squared, and let's call this b tau squared, and then e to the 2 tau, where tau is the logarithm. Well, here it's a choice of coordinates. But if you're in a conformal field theory, then a conformal field theory on a given metric is related to the conformal field theory on a different metric related by a conformal factor. So there is a transform that you can take from the theory defined on Euclidean R4 to the theory defined on around S3 times radial time, as we call it. And in this theory, you think of this d tau as your Euclidean time, which is the one that you analytically continue afterwards to become your Lorentzian time. And you have a round free sphere. So the point is that if you're doing a theory on the round S3 times R, that's equivalent via some conformal transformation to doing the theory on flat R4, and then the origin is removed. So when you have an operator and you insert it at the origin, the way you're supposed to think of this transformation is that you're changing the boundary conditions of the fields as you go towards the origin, which for this time corresponds to sending tau to minus infinity. So if you change the boundary conditions corresponding to time, going towards time minus infinity, what that really means is that you're providing a state on the theory. So this tells you that inserting an operator at the origin on Euclidean R4 is the same thing as giving a state of the theory on an S3. And this is the operator state correspondence. And we use this repeatedly in string theory. This is how we define vertex operators. The vertex operator represents a string theory state, and we represent it by a vertex operator. So the point is that you can represent states of your theory by local operators on the Euclidean field theory. And this makes the identification of states very easy, because you just write operators, and then you think of them as states in the theory. And then this is a very important concept in conformal field theory. And in many discussions, it is basically used without saying it, back and forth. But this is an important thing that one needs to keep track of, because that can lead to confusions sometimes. I'll get into a little bit more of that in a minute, because I want to do this very precisely for the free field theory. So there we'll realize what do we mean by operators. So what do we have? So now the question is really about discussing unitary reducible representations of the supergroup, which is SU22/4. And I'm going to concentrate for the time being on the conformal group, which is SO24. So this is very closely related to SO6. If you split this into 2,4 signature, and here you have an SO2, and here you have an SO4, then this SO2 in this splitting is the one that we associate to generator of dilatations, and it's the one that corresponds to dd tau. So dd tau, yes. the dd tau over here, and if you make this time become Lorentzian again, and you recover the old signature, the dd tau over here is the one that corresponds to this SO2 over here. And then there's an SO4, which is the isometries of the S3 left over. So this SO2 is the one that we associate to dd tau, which, when we go Euclidean, is the generator of translations in tau, which is the same thing as rescalings of R. So this is the stuff that corresponds to what we call the conformal dimension of an operator. So this is a non-compact SO2. Yeah. So this guy can have continuous spectrum. And then there's this SO4. And then we have these two off-diagonal components. So the SO4 in the Euclidean side is just the rotations fixing the origin. So if you use the usual Euclidean notation, these guys over here are what we would call M mu nu, the generators of rotations. And then there's these two off-diagonal things. Some of them are associated with what we call momentum, which generate translations in the R4. And then this corresponds to this side, let's say. And then the rest of the algebra is the extra set of generators of the conformal group, which are the special conformal transformations, which are usually denoted by K. And then you organize these according to the weight of these guys with respect to the generator dilatations. So delta and mu nu commute. So these have conformal weight 0. The commutation relation of delta and p gives you that p increases the dimension of delta of an object by 1. So here you have mu, And then K does the opposite. So this is minus 1. And this is the conformal weight of K. Now, when you build, or when you think of physics on a sphere, and you want to identify delta as your Hamiltonian, which is what we're doing when we're doing this, and if the field theory is well defined, you will have a ground state, which is a state of minimum energy, and on top of that, you have higher energy states. So the spectrum of delta is supposed to be semi-positive. And that means that if you act with K sufficiently many times on any state, you lower down the energy until there's no state left below. So the way you build unitary reducible representations is you start with states that are killed by all the Ks. So you add that K on the state is equal to 0. This would be the lowest weight state with respect to delta, or you can also think of it as a highest weight representation of a state. And when you go back to the operators over here, operators that are killed by K have a special name. So if O is an operator and K commutator with the operator is 0, then O is called a primary operator. Okay? So if K kills an operator, it's called the primary, and you're supposed to think about it as the lowest weight state in a given representation of the conformal group. And then you build the rest of the states by acting, or of that representation, by acting with P's and M's on the state, and that gives you your unitary reducible representation. So this is how one is supposed to begin. So to give a representation, you have to give the conformal weight, delta. That's the eigenvalue of delta on the lowest weight state. You're supposed to give the quantum groups under the SO4, which commutes with delta. So you also have two angular momenta, because SO4 is two copies of SU2s. And a unitary reducible representation of this group is classified by these three quantum numbers, which are the quantum numbers of the highest weight state of the representation, and everything else is determined from them. And then you can calculate the Casimirs and all the other stuff given these numbers. These two are compact SO4, so these are actually half integers. This guy is a non-compact SO2, so it can be an arbitrary real number. And now the usual story about non-renormalization of objects is that for discrete quantum numbers, you cannot renormalize them, but for continuous one, you can. So delta can change, but these two quantum numbers cannot. OK. Now, if you add the SO6, then you will also classify things by the SO6 representation of the highest weight state. So that's also given in terms of the Dynkin labels of the representation. So you get some L1, L2, L3 quantum numbers. And then because we don't have just this, but we also have supersymmetries. So we have supersymmetries, Q alpha. Alpha dot, and there's four of these guys. These are going to fit over here in the center. Q alpha, Q alpha dot. So these have weight 1/2, because the commutator of two of these guys gives you one of these. And the fact that these two guys have the same conformal weight is due to unitarity. So that's because this guy ends up being the complex conjugate of this guy. Okay? So just like you have the P mu and a K mu, these guys get their special conformal transformations added to them, and the special supersymmetries. So these have S alpha dot, and these are weight minus 1/2. And then if you're doing unitary reducible representations of this guy, you also have the SO6 over here. So the SO6 over here is what people call the R charges. And they have conformal weight 0. You don't change the conformal weight by acting in the symmetry. So the super conformal group is split into these pieces. You can repeat the highest weight construction for the full super algebra as opposed to just the bosonic part of the algebra. And then you require that all the guys that reduce the dimension be 0. So something which satisfies these two conditions, that k on s equal to 0 and s of s equal to 0, is called a superprimary. And if it's an operator that commutes with the generator of special conformal transformations and special supersymmetries, then you call that a superprimary operator. So all of this is just discussion of the supersymmetry algebra. And it's important to keep this straight to get the match between left and right. OK. Let me see what else. Now comes the tricky part, which is this is a theory with supersymmetry. And in theory with supersymmetry, you sometimes get smaller representations, and you can get supersymmetric special states. So you have a chiral primary operator, which is moreover annihilated by some of the Qs, then that space is that state is special. So this is annihilated by some number of the supersymmetries. So it's annihilated by these guys plus some of these, then the special guy is called a chiral primary. That's saying that you're annihilated by some of these guys. And if you do ordinary supersymmetric field theory, these chiral primaries without the special superconformal transformations are the things that become the chiral ring. So chiral primary states, the ones that are annihilated by some of the supersymmetries, are annihilated by some of the alphas, these become chiral operators. And then what people call the chiral ring is the cohomology of Q in the set of operators in a field theory. And one of the statements is that for every element of the chiral ring, you can actually find an honest operator which has the same dimension as the dimension of the operator in the chiral ring. So if you identify the chiral ring, you're able to identify a whole bunch of operators that are that you know their dimension exactly because of this property. So when you have these special states with reduced supersymmetry, what you find is that there's some unitarity bound that you're saturating. And the way the unitarity bound looks is something like delta greater than or equal to the R charge in appropriate units. And the statement is that for these type of guys, delta is equal to R. And these states are protected by supersymmetry. What that means is that the representation associated to this guy is small because some of the Qs acting on the highest weight state make it 0. So this representation is smaller than the usual ones where all the Qs can act on a state and give you something different. So these representations are small, and when you get them, these can be protected by supersymmetry. In the sense that if they stay there, then you can calculate their conformal weight exactly, given by the R charge. And you translate that into the theory on S3 by saying that you have a state whose energy is equal to the R charge. This is this is an SO6. And then, let me be more precise. The SO6 you can split into the Cartan, J1, J2, J3. So these are three SO2s sitting inside SO6. And this R charge that you get over here is what you would call J1 plus J2 plus J3. And usually you really get this with some change of signs in various places, and that depends on which of the supersymmetries you were using to get this unitarity bound. So once you choose some particular set of supersymmetries, you get a particular unitarity bound, and you can change that by going through different choices of supersymmetries. So when you choose a particular set of these supersymmetries, it's roughly the same thing as saying that in this SO6, you're picking a particular complex structure, and you're reducing this to some SU3 times U1 decomposition. And you're going to classify things according to this SU3. So you're picking a complex structure on this SO6. OK. Now we can actually get on with the program and do the matching of states. So when you have this equality, delta equals R, you have a BPS state. This is protected by supersymmetry. If you evaluate the quadratic Casimir of something like this, or by representation of this type, you find that the quadratic Casimir of the SU22/4 vanishes. And that's the Casimir of the SO24 minus the Casimir of the SO6. And when you try to think about this in terms of the isometry group of ADS5 cross S5, this quadratic Casimir is what people associate with the mass in 10 dimensions. So this quadratic Casimir is the mass squared in 10 dimensions. So saying that something is BPS is the same thing as saying that the associated particles in the 10-dimensional geometry are massless. And we know the type 2B string theory massless spectrum. So all of these is what falls under type 2B supergravity. OK? So the statement is that if you're doing BPS states, which are protected by supersymmetry, they're actually doing supergravity in ADS5 cross S5. OK. So now we're really at a point where we can start moving along. We'll get to those soon enough. We'll just start here. You start with the things with low conformal weight, and you work yourself up. It can be BPS at the point of what you would call small objects, point particles. This is correct, and there can be other things. Yes.
Are you saying that any question that you can ask in 10-dimensional supergravity can be answered exclusively in terms of BPS states and fluid theory?
No. Any BPS question that you ask in supergravity can be answered in terms of BPS states. right? Saying that all BPS states belong to supergravity is not the same thing as saying that all of supergravity is equal to being BPS. So the statement is that right. So here we're just studying the set of states. Okay. So now I can start talking about quick and easy way to understand point particles in 10 dimensions. So there's a couple of facts that you should know. Yes?
Yes,
symmetric linearized solution of linearized supergravity?
For some of them do. Some others are more than just linearized.
So is for small charge?
For small charge, yes.
So there are linearized solutions which preserve some supersymmetry.
Yeah, I'm going to go right into that.
Also, is it abstract deformation of the background?
So it's an infinitesimal deformation.
Infinitesimal, but is it can be made finite or can it be? I mean,
yeah, it can be made finite.
So there are plenty of solutions preserving.
Yeah, Juan wrote a whole bunch of them with Halim and Oleg Lunin.
Oh, I see. See.
So those are the ones that preserve actually one half of the supersymmetry.
And you can deform them smoothly with this?
Yes.
Also, each of this massless solution you can extend to finite. You can turn finite magnitude.
Yeah. But if you do that in the quantum theory, you have to be very careful. You have to do it using coherent states. Right. The point is that you have to go away from picking eigenstates of delta, and you have to really start to superpose states. Because we understand gravity solution. What you call a gravitational wave is really a coherent state of gravitational quanta. And a coherent state does not have fixed number of particles or fixed energy. So we have to go away from just looking at states of fixed delta, and we really have to go into coherent states. If you want to match solutions of classical gravity. And this is an important point. Okay. So let me start with the some very special operators, which are the ones that are half BPS. So half BPS means that you preserve half of the supersymmetry, so half of these guys annihilate your state. And the highest weight state is constrained so that J1 is different than 0, and J2, J3 are equal to 0. Okay? So these are special type of operators. And you can write some chiral primaries which have those quantum numbers. Yes. Well, it's the highest weight state of a half BPS multiplet has this property. So we're going to look for states that satisfy this condition exactly. So this is easy to do. You just look, because the states are BPS, you can analyze them in free field theory. In free field theory, you have the spectrum of the Young-Mills theory. You have a photon. You have spinners. Then you have three complex scalars, x, y, z, x bar, y bar, z bar. When I write them in this complex notation, I've picked a particular choice of complex structure associated to a particular set of splitting the supersymmetries. So when I write it in this way, I'm already taking advantage of that holomorphicity or that complex structure. And the R charge of X in these quantum numbers has R charge J2, but J1 equal to 0 and J3 equal to 0. This is by convention. The same thing with Y. Z is the one that we call usually by convention, the one associated to the half BPS bound. And then what you do is you write an operator which is trace of Z to the N, for example. It has to be local. It has to be gauge invariant. And this operator in the free field theory is half BPS. I can actually take multiple products of these traces. And all of these are protected by supersymmetry. It turns out that half BPS multiplets are very special in that they cannot get lifted by pairing up with other states. So any state which starts its life as a half BPS state in the free theory is protected, and it cannot get an anomalous dimension, and you can find all of these states in the field theory. So there's a huge number of these states, and if you have energy K, you split it into traces of possible numbers. And then there's the statement that at some point you reach a place where the traces become algebraically dependent, because you're dealing with n-by-n matrices. So the statement is that traces give you a representation of all these operators, but it's a redundant representation, because traces of n-by-n matrices for sufficiently high powers become algebraically dependent on lower numbers of traces. So this is an overcomplete set of states. And whenever something happens where these dimensions depend on how big the matrices are, and something gets cut, you call it a stringy exclusion principle. So invoke the stringy exclusion principle. It means that you don't write all of the possibilities, but just the ones that satisfy some constraints. And that constraint is what you call the string exclusion principle. It's the usual thing. I'll give you the constraint. The constraint is that all of these labels, alpha I, have to be less than or equal to n. N is a finite number, then you take the product of all the compositions of N into integers, you have energy K. K is the sum of all of these numbers, alpha 1 plus alpha S, and you choose the compositions of K into integers that are smaller than or equal to N. We'll get to that in a minute. For one matrix, this is all the constraints. For more matrices, it gets more hairy. Yes. I can give you a generating function. The sum of AI. No. That's more messy. They're just talking half VPS states. Now, here's a curiosity. If you're doing BPS states in supergravity and you're doing single particle graviton BPS states, you can associate them to a null geodesic in ADS5 cosine spine. And it'll be a generic null geodesic. So here you have ADS5. Here you have DS5. A geodesic on ADS5 cosine spine. A null geodesic on ADS5 cosine spine. If it moves on the S5, it's space-like on the S5, and it has to be time-like on the ADS5. And because these are homogeneous spaces, you can actually rotate all time-like geodesics to staying at the origin in some particular coordinate system, which I'm going to give you, which is global coordinate system of ADS5. So you write...
Do you have a representation argument for that, for why that has to be true? So why does it have to be geodesic, for example?
Well, if it's a graviton and it's a massless particle, then it should follow geodesics. The gravitons are not charged under other fields other than gravity, so it has to move in null geodesics. So let me write ADS5 in global coordinates, and that means that the ds squared is cos rho squared dt squared, the minus sign, plus d rho squared plus sinh squared rho d omega 3 squared. So you split your ADS5 into a time slicing dt. This time slicing dt actually corresponds to this generator. So translations in T correspond exactly to this generator delta that we identified here, just by matching the isometric groups and to the conformal group over here. This global time over here, you just stay at the origin, and then you spin around on the S5, and you're spinning on a diameter. And all those null geodesics are conjugate to each other under the bosonic part of the superconformal group.
You're motivating null geodesics because that's what massless particles follow.
That's what massless particles follow.
That's the only motivation right now.
So if you have actually a wave representing a massless particle moving on this null geodesics, you have to ask how many creases that wave has on the diameter. Yes?
A question on identifying this with the what you called time in radial quantization earlier. So it's not obvious that they are the same thing directly, because if you look at how you got your radial time before, you were taking over a patch and continuing, and you looking at that.
Okay, let me get to that in the following way. Take global ADS with this slicing. Now, the conformal boundary in this representation corresponds to taking rho to infinity. And rho is the radial direction. The asymptotic formula of cosine squared of rho is e to the 2 rho. And of sin squared rho is e to the 2 rho.
I agree. It looks like the same method.
Hold it. The conformal boundary of ADS5 is remove the radial direction and we scale the conformal factor of the other stuff. And you get the dt squared and the d omega 3 squared. And you get a product metric. So you identify the Killing vector of ddt on the boundary and you fill it in to the Killing vector of ddt in the inside. This covers the full of ADS.
Yeah, this Fine. Does.
Yeah. Yes, and the S3 cross R covers the full boundary of ADS in these coordinates. So the strongest statement of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that you actually do it for an S3 times R compactification of the N equal 4, and this covers global ADS-5 cross S5. And you do it for the usual flat field theory case, you're just covering the Poincaré patch. And then the identification of time there is with one of these things that we call P over here, but not with this guy. Yeah. Okay, so the point is that going back to null geodesics, to characterize a wave function associated to a null geodesic, you have to count how many creases of the wave you have around the circle. And that gives you an integer, n. And using the energy-momentum relation, this is the number of creases is the momentum along the S5. So this is j. And if you calculate the energy, it has to be also equal to n. What you find is that point particles, at least in the semi-classical approximation for massless particles, are all half BPS. And then you can actually go and check that all the representation theory can be written in terms of these half BPS states. And the point is that these guys are captured by a single quantum number, which is the number or a half PPS multiplet associated to one of these things is captured exclusively by the number of creases you have on the S5. And this quantum number characterizes the full SU22/4 irreducible representation associated to that gravity. Okay, so here comes the hindsight of Whitson. And I'm going to give you the next two references, which is 98.02.109 and H 98.02.50. So what Witten described is that all of the supergravity multiplets as calculated by Ewenhausen correspond exactly to descendants of one of these single traces. So the full tower of spherical harmonics of ADS 5 cross S5 can really be written in terms of unitary reducible representations of SU22/4 as descendants of a single particle with one unit n. And he said this unit that we have over here, n, is the same thing as this index power appearing in each one of these traces. So this is interpreted, a single trace is interpreted as a one graviton state. Multi-traces are interpreted as multi-graviton states. And the key for that is that when you think of multi-traces, it looks like a Fock space. And this Fock space is a good approximation in the large n limit for these numbers fixed. So the identification to a Fock space is in the strict infinite n limit. At large n, you have an approximate Fock space, and the approximation is good. And then the string exclusion principle that we get over here is in some sense the statement that single particle gravitons somehow disappear for sufficiently large wave number inside the S5.
Was there any constraint on the original or on the individual alphas, or there's also a constraint on the sum?
There's no constraint on the sum. It's just on the individual alpha. Okay, so the reason why it's called the string exclusion principle in this interpretation is that the number of algebraically independent traces are finite. So there's some cap on how many gravitons you can have. But
question: so how do you know that for an arbitrary quantum number, this particle doesn't back react, or you don't have to consider that, or not?
Well, this is half PPS, and then. In the field theory, another way to characterize BPS operators is that they can actually get a VEV on a non-trivial supersymmetric vacuum. This is another version of what the chiral ring is. If you follow these guys, they can all get non-zero VEVs on a supersymmetric vacuum, which is not conformally invariant. So all of these guys are protected by supersymmetry using this argument. The other statement is that if you start with these guys, they can never receive quantum corrections because the half BPS multiplets can never combine into bigger irreducible representations or into bigger representations because they would violate unitarity if they do so.
Yeah. My question was on the gravity side. So
on the gravity side, you're stuck with the statement that for some reason, quantum gravity tells you that the number of independent gravitons stops at sufficiently high quantum number. And when you calculate the associated quantum number in terms of L Planck units, it's really, really tells you that something is happening to geometry at L Planck. Mm-hmm. This is what you're seeing.
I mean, this is an effect of large string couplings.
The gravitational constant on ADS5 is independent.
One of our incorrections.
Yeah, this is one of our incorrections. N to infinity, there's no constraint. This is G string, yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, if the genus expansion is the gravitational expansion, then. Not within the framework of supergravity. But if you were being naive about supergravity, you would say that this is an oddity of quantum gravity.
I could keep g squared n large.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not a question of high curvature on the phenomenon. It is a question.
It's not a Planck length.
Well,
well, the Planck length of the S5 in ADS units, or ADS 5%, goes like n to the 1 quarter. So L of ADS is L10, which is the L Planck 10 dimensions times n to the 1 quarter. And if you do it with L string units, you get a different answer. Let me write it like this. G string times n to the 1 quarter. Okay. So the statement is, if you have these states, you go to strong coupling, you're supposed to match them with supergravity, and you can identify single traces with individual gravitons. Now let's play the operator state correspondence game. So this is the operator language. And let me play this game at the level of free field theory. So I need to look for states which are invariant under SO4 rotations and that are built out of Z. So if you play the operator state correspondence game, what you realize is that you're exciting things that are spherically symmetric on the S5, on the S3. And the way you're supposed to identify these fields over here, when you do the conformal transformation, you end up having some S3 compactification of your Young-Mills theory, and you expand it into spherical harmonics of the S3. So that gives you an infinite number of n by n matrices, one for each spherical harmonic. And the energy associated to these matrices contains the angular momentum on the S3 squared, and then there's also the R charge, these guys. So if you want states where the energy is equal to the R charge, I have this one. If you want states where the energy is equal to the R charge, then the angular momentum on the S3 has to be zero. And the you end up with just S waves of the field Z on the S3. So you have the field Z on your S3. You have some piece which is a raising operator with positive frequency. And it has some annihilation piece with negative frequency. And when you write trace of Z to the alpha 1 acting on the vacuum and you calculate its energy, what you're really doing is you're forgetting that there's this annihilation operator piece, and you're just acting with the raising operator part of the field Z on the vacuum. And then everything is built out of one set of matrices of raising operators. So this is equivalent to doing a free matrix model for one Hermitian matrix in the harmonic oscillator. So we're doing free field theory at the moment. So free field theory. Well, when you write this state trace of Z to the alpha acting on the vacuum, and you calculate its energy, what you're really doing is all the annihilation operator, this has opposite charge to this one, so these two guys commute. This is complex. This has R charge 1, this has R charge 1, these two commute. So what you're really keeping is just the raising part of the operator. This is the statement that in these operators, you never have to worry about self-contractions. Okay. So the point is that in the free field theory limit, which is where we are studying this problem, you end up with just traces of this set of n by n matrices, the raising operator. So this is equivalent at the quantum level of just dealing with one Hermitian matrix. Hermitian matrix. Quantum mechanics for the harmonic oscillator. I had a complex field. Yes. Yes.
It's not Hermitian, and now you say that's the same as the harmonic oscillator, which is an annihilation.
Right. So the point is that you also have Z bar, which also has a raising operator with charge minus 1 into minus I omega t. You're really doing the Hamiltonian reduction in the sense that you're setting these states to the vacuum, so you never act with Z bar on your state. And then you keep the destruction operator in the Z bar, which is the conjugate of this one. And then with these two, you can build a real Hermitian matrix. And because of the commutation relations between A and A dagger, you build its momentum. So this is having a Hamiltonian x squared plus b squared 2. And then by taking x plus ip, I can build A dagger, and x minus ip, I can build the other one. But if I just do the math, the Hilbert space of states is equivalent to the Hilbert space of states of a single Hermitian matrix model, quantum mechanics in the harmonic oscillator potential. But you also have this restriction to traces over here. When you follow that through, what you really mean is that you're studying this Hermitian matrix quantum mechanics in the singlet sector. So you can just as well consider it as the gauged Hermitian matrix quantum mechanics. Gauge Hermitian. What? S-U-N. Actually, U-N here. Well, it doesn't matter. It says U-N. One? Yes. If you follow the dimensional reduction to just these modes, you'll notice that a zero does not carry physical states, but survives in the effective, how I call it, reduction. The S wave of the A zero survives the reduction to the quantum mechanics. And then you can keep track of the Gauss's constraint of A zero in this reduction. And this is what you're doing. Yes?
This quantum mechanics is valid specifically for the purpose of calculating the spectrum, but if you try to put any time
difference or anything else, you don't. Well, for half EPS states, you do get some specific time dependence, which is dictated by the E equals J constraint. Which is the dimension.
Right, but you can't take this quantum mechanics and then calculate its full set of amplitudes. And
right. You might have some trouble. You might have some trouble understanding observables.
Yeah, you shouldn't call it Hamiltonian. You should call it the Hamiltonian.
Well, I prefer to think about it as the Hamiltonian operator in this S3 cross R. Right. This is. I like to think in terms of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so you end up in this Hermitian matrix quantum mechanics. And you say, big deal, you know, it's just a matrix quantum mechanics. But this problem is very well understood. You can solve it in various ways. One of them is just writing these traces over here. This is one representation. And that's that. There's another way to solve it, which is that since the matrix is Hermitian and we have SUN transformations, and the action on X is by U, X inverse, so it's by conjugation, it descends from the gauge transformations of N equal 4 Young-Mills on the on the full theory, and these are adjoints, so they transform by conjugation. So you can always choose this Hermitian matrix and diagonalize it. Because of the gauge symmetry. So you're using the gauge symmetry to reduce the number of degrees of freedom. So you go from n squared degrees of freedom on a matrix to n degrees of freedom, which are the eigenvalues. And then you can write everything in terms of wave functions of the eigenvalues. Okay. This is quantum mechanics, so when you make changes of variables, you have to be careful. This is like going from Euclidean coordinates to spherical coordinates. And when you calculate your quantum mechanical problem at a classical level, you just go from this thing to diagonal matrices, and the diagonal matrices have nice time evolution because you're just keeping e to the I omega t and forgetting this component. So what you're really saying is that your matrices have a first order dynamics because z dot is equal to z. And if you remember BPS conditions, they usually reduce from second order dynamics to first order dynamics. Okay? So you diagonalize it, you get n eigenvalues, and there's a change of measure from going to from here to here. And this change of measure is very well known. It's mu squared is the Vandermonde matrix of Z. No, I'm using the gauge symmetry to eliminate most of the degrees of freedom of x and keep the stuff that is invariant. The eigenvalues themselves are not exactly invariant. They're invariant up to permutations. So you're keeping these guys. You have these change of variables. And you have to write boson wave functions for them. Mu squared measure. This is delta. This is the Vandermonde determinant. So so you write your matrix quantum mechanics. You have these measure terms. So where you calculate overlaps of wave functions, you have to keep track of this measure term. But if you absorb this measure in the wave function, so you just find psi hat, which is mu times psi. And this psi hat is a wave function where you don't need to keep track of mu. To make your calculations, and then mu is completely anti-symmetric in the eigenvalues of z. And when you do this, actually the Hamiltonian becomes free. This is well-known stuff by Bresanitsky, Sopers, and Zuber, and it's very well known for a long time. So you end up with free fermions in the harmonic oscillator. And then, because when we started over here, z was a complex variable, you actually want to go to a complex representation of the wave functions. So you want to actually work on phase space as opposed to just on x space. And this is a technicality, but it makes you draw pretty pictures. And then this is a problem of fermions in the harmonic oscillator in a two-dimensional phase space. So we know what that is. And you write the ground state, you get a circle. This is the statement that you have fermions, so they repel each other. They cannot all be on the same ground state. And you end up fitting ground states on phase space until you reach the energy of the Fermi C. So here you have E Fermi. When you look at these traces, these are collective excitations of these fermions. You can build coherent states out of them. And with these coherent states, which is exponentials of these traces of Z dagger to various powers, you can show that these coherent states give you droplet deformations with specific numbers of creases around the circle. And this is very well known in condensed matter physics. People have done this to exhaustion. This is part of the quantum Hall effect literature, part of bosonization, part of very old problem in physics. Because they're fermions, we can also consider other types of states, which are semi-classical. One of them is to just take one eigenvalue from the Fermi C and put it way over here. So this is a fermion. And then these guys over here, where you've separated something from the Fermi C, are things that in the supergravity description were identified with what we call giant gravitons. So this is a particular D-brain. You can also make holes. If you make a hole in your theory, this is another type of D-brain. This is another giant graviton. And then what we call this Fock space of supergravity modes is just creases on these edge waves on the Fermi C excitations. So this is a pretty picture. But the surprise is that this picture actually matches exactly what you seem to get from supergravity. And I don't want to go into all the details, but let me give you an idea of what you expect to be able to describe with supergravity. So if you just don't take one fermion, but a lot of them, and you condense them together, this is putting a lot of D-brains on top of each other. A lot of D-brains on top of each other can be understood in terms of the near-horizon geometry around the collection of D-brains. So you expect that if you put a lot of eigenvalues on top of each other, this is a big stack of D-brains in the supergravity. You can replace the stack of D-brains by the deformation of the supergravity solution that they generate. The same thing over here for big holes. And the same thing for coherent state excitations of the Fermi C. So these are just ordinary gravitational waves. So you would think that the most general configuration that you can analyze using supergravity should be described in terms of fermion pictures on a two-plane. The most general half-PPS configuration. And this is exactly what Lin Lunin and Maldacena did. So let me give you a complete set of references. So we're running out of time. So you tell me when to stop. Okay. PH 0409174, and this stuff of the Fermi C is in PH 0403190. So the point is that if you get to this fermion description, you think that you might be able to describe all of these objects by supergravity. And the construction of Lin Lunin and Maldacena shows that after you do really good analysis of the supergravity, keeping track of all the symmetries and the supersymmetries and the supersymmetry constraints and everything that you know about the symmetry of the system, you end up with a description of smooth supergravity solutions which are described exactly by pictures in two dimensions with two colors. In two colors. You get everything in terms of it's black and white. Right? You get a two coloring of the plane with, and everything is written in terms of a function with a specific set of boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are on this two-dimensional section of the geometry. And these boundary conditions are due to regularity of the supergravity solution. And it's written in terms of a function that can take two values on this particular plane. They take values plus minus 1/2 in their notation. So the description of all half PPS states in supergravity is a picture which is essentially identical to this one.
How did this relate to the risk solutions that
So those solutions are actually where you take the density of fermions and sort of dilute it. And instead of having density 1, they have lower density. And these solutions are singular.
So you said the second is you get all half BBS supergravity.
Regular solutions, yeah.
You know that because you can classify them as on the supergravity side.
Yes.
By solving the BBS condition.
By solving the BBS condition. And in the field theory side, you get it by doing these free fermions. So the claim is that this is, since this picture is part of the geometry of ADS5 crosses 5 in a very particular slicing, that one should identify this phase space of free fermions identically with this slice of the geometry of ADS5 crosses 5.
Is it clear that it's actually the same picture, like non-compressible fluid and all?
Yes.
In the supergravity side?
In the supergravity side, the incompressibility of the fluid is tied to flux quantization. So the area becomes the flux of the self-dual Ramon Ramon field, and then this has to be an integer over every non-trivial topological cycle. And this, the fact that it comes as an integer gives you a quantization of area on these solutions, both of the black regions and of the white regions. Any more questions?
Supposing we look at state switcher invariant under less supersymmetry.
Okay, this is. Yes.
Just asking a question. Should those correspond to non-singular geometry?
Not all of them. Just like not all of these half EPS solutions correspond to non-singular geometries. All the non-singular ones are written in terms of this black and white painting of the plane. The singular ones is where you let the black bleed off and become gray. In terms of the free fermions, what happens is that when you try to describe the density of fermions, you are doing some half-filling or something like that, and then the claim by various people is that when you have something which is gray in the thermodynamic limit, in a coarse-graining approximation, there's a lot of states that have the same density locally.
When you say gray, you mean partial.
Yes. So when you do a coarse-graining type description of the density of fermions, you can get a subcritical density. So they could not be as tightly packed as you could have.
Should really be states in the Hilbert space?
There are states in the Hilbert space. They're not states that correspond to a nice supergravity approximation. Well, there are states in the Hilbert space. They're just not. You wouldn't call it a geometrical phase of supergravity because you have this singularity and you have to say what happens at the singularity. It's not a smooth solution of supergravity. You can find solutions of supergravity which have these gray boundary conditions, and you can also find fermion wave functions which give you this partial filling of a disk. And then the issue boils down to how much detail you know about this distribution and whether you're just taking some coarse-graining approximation or whether you know the details of where every fermion is. Yes? You would not have this matrix model. Yeah, but not too many. And this is the point that you can make. That if you look at things that preserve 1/8 of the supersymmetries, then they also all fall into the supergravity regime. So all of the states associated to 1/8 BPS states are part of the supergravity as well. Because the condition of energy equals J tells you that your particles are still massless. The point is that a single particle gravitational wave is part of a half BPS multiplet. But if you do multi-particle states, they could be half BPS with respect to different supersymmetries. Right? And when you put them all together, they'll only preserve the common supersymmetry of the two objects. No, there's no fermions anymore. The fermions is some peculiarity of this one-dimensional matrix model. And they're not free anymore either. But the point is that you can try to follow the same route, and you find the matrix model not of one matrix, but of many matrices. And these are made out of S waves of the three complex scalar fields as opposed to just one of them. These are just chiral ring operators. Yes. They correspond to a singular supergravity solution. Something stringy could be happening. We don't have a general description. You have a singular. Yes. Take your favorite quantum hole, how they call it, state of filling fraction 1 over k. This is also an incompressible fluid with, how they call it. It really depends on the states. Which states correspond to what?
The type of singularity you get is different depending on whether the density, let's say, smaller than one or bigger than one.
Yeah.
But for bigger than one, it's sort of the worst kind of singularity.
Perfectly good.
Singularity is a so-called non-singularity. It's
close to my curve.
Non-recurrence.
Right. So when you get these closed time-like curve scenarios, what you're really doing is doing something over the Fermi density. So you're really violating unitarity in your Fermi theory because you're basically packing too many states on top of each other. So if you have an over-density in the Fermi theory, you'll never get it because of the Fermi exclusion principle, Fermi statistics.
Bring in the quantum Hall effect. These fermions are free.
These are free, but they're in a two-dimensional phase space. And this is the same thing as doing free fermions in a strong magnetic field. When you reduce
fractional quantum Hall state, the reason it exists is that there's a
Coulomb. This is the integer quantum Hall effect.
Did you say 1 over k?
No, you can pick a fractional quantum Hall effect state, which is also a solution of the free theory. It is just not the minimal energy state. It's just a state. Yeah, you can write such a wave function.
Wait, but can't you do this if the electrons are free? Don't you need the electromagnetic interaction for fractions?
No. No, you can treat them as free. They're coupled to an electromagnetic field, but there's no back reaction of the electromagnetic field to the presence of the fermion. This is a statement that when you take a fermion in the lowest Landau level and you describe the orbit of the fermion by the position of the center of the circle, that the classical electron orbit is doing, the coordinates of that center do not commute on phase space. So you get that the reduction to lowest Landau level gives you a phase space. So it's the fact that you get here these pictures on phase space that lets you identify with the integer quantum Hall effect.
So if you take the fractional states, then those also singular, but they're not elemental. Yeah, that's kind of
singular.
I'm not sure how to answer that question. Right? When you're doing, let's say, classical solutions of gravity or something like that, usually you impose some type of regularity conditions. And these regularity conditions might not be there in a full solution of your quantum theory. And this just tells you that, in some sense, the semi-classical limit that you took is breaking down in some technical sense. But it doesn't mean that the solution is not allowed. It just means that you have to think about it as a quantum solution to your problem.